perhaps 20 degrees across parts of East Anglia and the southeast. In Northern Ireland, a cloudy start to the day. Outbreaks of rain spreading into Antrim and Down before the end of the day, so turning wet here. And in Scotland, staying dull, cool and cloudy across eastern areas with occasional spots of rain. The west could see a few showers, but there'll be occasional brighter spells here. That's latest weather. Vaughan.
Many thanks, Chris. Now, our book of the week this week is the new memoir by the academic and writer John Carey. In 1952, having won an open scholarship to Oxford, the young Carey was expected to first do his national service. After completing basic training, he was sent to officer cadet school at Eton Hall in Cheshire. It was to be the beginning of a year in which he experienced a very different kind of education. Nicholas Farrell reads The Unexpected Professor by John Carey.
It was at Eton Hall that I first came across the English class system. Most of the cadets were from public schools. They talked in public school voices and tended to have unbelievable names. In our squad alone, there was a Fitzherbert Brockholes and a Fernley Whittingstall. Thanks to TV, names like that are commonplace now, but in post-war socialist Britain, they seemed comic and offensive, and their harmless proprietors filled my mind with tumbrils and guillotines. We were drilled every day by apoplectic sergeant majors from the Brigade of Guards, and we went to battle camp in Wales, where we launched ferocious platoon attacks against inoffensive corrugated iron shacks, riddling them with Bren gun fire and pounding them with 2-inch mortars. The NCO in charge was Corporal Recton, a tough infantryman with a neat row of medal ribbons over his breast pocket. Once, during training, we had to jump off a brick hut. It was 8 or 9 feet high, and we lined up on the roof. We were more encumbered than you would normally choose to be for jumping off a roof, wearing backpacks and steel helmets and carrying rifles. But it was no ordeal, and one by one we duly thudded to the earth. Suddenly, though, there was a halt. The next man to jump stood shuddering on the roof's edge, his face twisted in terror. I want to say that he was one of the toffee-nosed public school types, and I truly believe he was, but that may be just my prejudice. Some sniggering broke out amongst those of us on the ground, but Corporal Recton rounded on us in fury. "Stop that!" he yelled. "It's more difficult for him than it is for you." He talked quietly to the frightened man, who eventually jumped, and we returned to camp, having learned something more important than how to jump off a roof. My orders were to join the 1st Battalion of the East Surrey Regiment in Egypt. They were stationed at Tel El Kebir, which was a stretch of barren desert about 100 kilometres northeast of Cairo, where, during the war, the 8th Army had created an enormous depot of ordnance and vehicles. An infantry brigade, of which the Surreys were a part, was responsible for guarding it. Some months into my time in Egypt, we were on detachment, guarding a filtration plant near the Sweetwater Canal that runs from Cairo to Suez. I was sharing a room with a new officer called Bobby, just out from England. My early warning system had instantly diagnosed him as public school, but on the other hand, he was very nice, polite, fresh-faced and boyish. One night we were discussing guns, and Bobby admitted that he had never actually fired a 3/8 revolver of the kind officers carried. He had heard, he said, that there were 2 pressures on the trigger, but he did not understand what that meant. Eager to demonstrate my superior skills with weaponry, I drew my own revolver and pointed it at the door. "Oh, it's quite easy," I explained. "You take the first pressure like this," tightening my trigger finger a little, "and then you take the second, like this." At that moment, several things happened simultaneously. There was a sharp crack, a neat hole appeared in the door, I turned to stone, and Bobby's eyes opened wider than I had ever seen eyes open before. As the blood gradually seeped back into my brain, I realized he was wondering if this was a perfectly usual way of teaching the use of small arms in the East Surreys, or whether, alternatively, he was shut in a room with a madman who might easily shoot him next. However, A far more pressing concern thrust itself on my attention. Outside the door were the tents containing the sleeping soldiery of the East Surreys, one of them possibly with a 3-8 bullet lodged in him. Stumbling round tents at night, waking up soldiers to ask if they are still alive, is not a task that earns you universal popularity. But Bobby and I stuck to it until we were quite sure the company would not be one man short when it lined up for inspection next morning. By this time, a sleep-befuddled Major Reed, commander of C Company, had arrived, asked a couple of questions, told me curtly to report to him first thing next morning, and gone back to bed. I did not spend a peaceful night. The next morning, standing to attention before his desk, I was forced to admire with a small, detached, literary critical portion of my mind the colour, variety, cogency, rhetorical incisiveness, and dramatic force of his language, even though its purport was far from complimentary to me. That evening we dined together as usual, and both behaved as if nothing had happened. I had made friends with another second lieutenant called Derek. We talked about ways of getting out of Tel El Kebir and hit on the idea of a trip to the monastery of St. Catherine in the Sinai. Officially, it was to be an armed reconnaissance by the intelligence section with Derek as escort. But really, it was a holiday. We took two Land Rovers, whose drivers were glad of the break, and loaded into them everything we'd want for a week away. Sinai in those days was virtually unvisited. There were no roads, just sand tracks between gaunt, jagged mountains that looked just as they must have when Moses led the Israelites across this peninsula to the Promised Land. The monastery, as we first saw it, coming over the final rocky ridge, was a never-to-be-forgotten wonder. I had not known it was a fortress as well as a monastery. Its granite walls shot up sheer from the desert, with no window or aperture. In the evening light, they looked rosy and smooth enough to stroke. Above it loomed the craggy, boulder-strewn mass of Mount Sinai, where God gave Moses the Ten Commandments. We were not very welcome. At length, a monk appeared. He was robed in black, with a flat-topped black hat as worn by Greek Orthodox clergy, and had a grizzled beard. Eyeing our armaments, he expressed regret that the monastery did not receive overnight guests, but said he would show us round next day. So we unrolled our sleeping bags on the warm sand and took turns on guard duty till dawn. He came to see us after breakfast and took us inside. It was like a little town, and utterly deserted. Perhaps the other monks were at prayers or hiding in their cells. After the glaring light outside, the basilica was too dark for us to see anything, so we had to take it on trust when our monk extolled its rare and splendid icons. We declined his offer to show us the charnel house, and he declined our request to see the library. In 1844, a German visitor called von Tischendorf, to whom the monks showed their treasures, took away with him a large portion of the oldest surviving manuscript of the Bible, the Codex Sinaiticus, which had never been returned and is now in the British Library. Memory of his theft evidently lingered, so we had to make do with a peep through the library door. However, we were shown the burning bush and photographed it for reconnaissance purposes. It did not look a healthy shrub. The monastery garden, on the other hand, enclosed in its fortified wall, was lush and fragrant. Date palms, lemon trees, olives, and figs spread their grateful shade. I came away thinking perhaps an Oxford college would be quite like this monastery. The seclusion, the scholarly calm, the garden. It was not a very accurate prediction. Really, the officer's mess was a better preparation for college life. Being on the left in politics, and rather austerely brought up, I should have been superior to the pleasures the mess offered. But in fact, I found them completely captivating. I was deeply impressed by the sophistication of some of the older regular army lieutenants. These majestic beings did not, of course, address second lieutenants, apart from the odd bit of chaff, but I listened to them with care, noting their haughty preference of masala to port, for example, and admiring the graceful turn of the wrist with which, at dinner, they would pour half the contents of their sherry glass into their clear soup. I practiced it back in my tent using an egg cup. Once a week there was a dinner night at which attendance was obligatory. We wore white monkey jackets with miniature regimental badges on the lapels, dress shirts, black bow ties, maroon cummerbunds, and number one dress trousers, dark blue with a broad red stripe. All this peacockery might seem pointless given that no women were present, but it was like nothing I had ever known, and I was enthralled. We were flown home in an RAF Dakota, and before we crossed the Egyptian coast, the pilot came up on the intercom saying that he would take us on a sweep across the Delta first to see the pyramids. I prepared to be awed. But as I looked down at them under the tilting wing, I found I was thinking of the thousands of people who had slaved and died to erect these blank-looking monuments to tyranny and stupid self-aggrandizement. Then I thought of the village children we had seen, with sores on their faces, and of the rich, fat slobs who got out of their flash cars at our checkpoints. And it seemed to me that Egypt had been going on in the same way for thousands of years, and the pyramids, so famed and fabled, were just another shameful manifestation of it. As we flew on, and I thought a bit more, I realized that what I was hating had nothing specifically to do with Egypt, but was far more widespread and stretched through human history. Then I thought of an army chaplain I had met, and how much I had admired him. And it came to me that, though I thought of myself as an agnostic, I was really a Christian who just didn't happen to believe in God. As a choir boy, I had sung the Magnificat hundreds of times, praising God for putting down the mighty from their seat and sending the rich empty away. And my belief that this was right, and that the mighty and the rich deserved to be humbled and to go hungry, had outlasted my belief in God. The other thing that struck me forcibly after the Dakota touched down in England was that the neatly uniformed member of the Women's Royal Air Force who came tripping across the tarmac to greet us was a very nice shape, and that living without a woman as I had for a year and a half was a mistake. Armed with this admittedly rather random set of critical convictions, I looked forward to getting my teeth into English literature when I went up to Oxford. I didn't feel I belonged in Oxford. For the first week or so, I slunk around like an intruder, quite prepared to be detained and ejected if spotted. I think this would have been worse if I hadn't been in the army beforehand. In the army, I'd learned to pretend. Pretend to be a soldier, pretend to be an officer, and it had worked, more or less. So I found it relatively easy to pretend to be like the other St. John's freshmen, with the same background and interests, and they accepted unquestioningly that I was. I suppose a lot of them were pretending too. I had two rooms, a bedroom looking out on St. Giles, and a sitting room come study. My Bakelite wireless had come with me, and now I had a second possession, a Russell Hobbs electric coffee pot, donated by my parents. On my first day in Oxford, I went to Woolworths in the corn market and bought sensible plain white plates, cups and saucers that I knew my mother would approve of. As I arranged them on the empty shelves in a cupboard, I felt I was creating a home base in a possibly hostile land.
Nicholas Farrell was reading from The Unexpected Professor by John Carey. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast is moments away, and to get us there, as usual, sailing by. Thank you. sailing by. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Thursday, the 3rd of April. There are warnings of gales in Bailey. The general synopsis at 1800, low, West Seoul, 984, expected 100 miles west of Rockall, 990 by 1800 Thursday. New low, expected central England, 999 by the same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sierra, south at Sierra, northeast 40s. Variable, 3 or 4 in north at Sierra, otherwise southeasterly, 4 or 5. Mainly fair, moderate or good. Southwest 40s, Cromarty. Southeasterly, 4 or 5, increasing 6 at times. Fair, then occasional rain, moderate or poor. Fourth, Tyne, Dogger. East or southeast, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later. Occasional rain, fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. Fisher, east, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later. Mainly fair, moderate or good. German Bight, Humber. East, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later. Fog patches at first, moderate or poor.